from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Thuy Vu, in for Michael Krasny. The Bay Area beer world is booming, with craft breweries and beer gardens popping up all over the region. We'll talk with a panel of experts about the local beer scene, the increasing popularity of new varieties such as sour beers, and tips for home brewing and pairing beer with food. That's coming up in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Thuy Vu, in today for Michael Krasny. Well, with the Memorial Day weekend approaching, no doubt there will be a lot of barbecues this Saturday and Sunday, and no doubt a lot of beer to go with all those burgers, hot dogs, and ribs. But beer isn't just for barbecues and sporting events anymore. It's getting a more glamorous sheen. There are now beer pairings with gourmet food and more than 100 styles of beers, from porters to pilsners to IPAs. We're going to spend this hour talking all about the evolution of beer. And joining us are Justin Crossley, founder of The Brewing Network, a podcast focused on craft beers and home brewing. He's also the co-founder of Hop Grenade Tap House in Concord. Good morning, Justin.
Good morning.
Also with us in the studio is Sean Paxton. He's a writer, chef, and founder of Homebrew Chef, a website focused on beer cuisine. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And also, Nicole Ernie is here. She is one of 11 master Cicerones in the world, and in case you're wondering what that is, that's sort of like a sommelier for beer. And she was the first female master Cicerone. She's a former bartender at the Trappist in Oakland and now runs her own consulting firm and works as well with the Cicerone Certification Program. Good morning, Nicole.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I have to say, I love you all, but I'm terribly disappointed that none of you brought any beer and food for us this morning.
We failed already.
Yeah. I thought about it. Beer and breakfast, you know, it's a good thing.
You know, that could be a new trend right there, the evolution of beer. Well, Justin, let's start off with you. You have a whole radio network, a whole, a podcast network devoted to just beer. Exactly how many different styles of beer are out there, and which ones are the most popular right now?
Oh, man. Nicole's better at answering how many. I'll tell you, I'm going to get this wrong. 126-ish? Am I even close, Nicole?
No, it's somewhere around there. There's a few different groups that kind of keep track of beer styles. But then even with all of the beer styles that exist, there's always going to be beers brewed outside of style for fun. So it's hard to pin it, but around 150 probably.
And for popularity, you know, it's been this way for years. It's still this way. It will be for some time. The India Pale Ale, IPA, is still the most popular beer in, I should say most popular craft beer in the U.S. Everybody loves big hoppy, not necessarily bitter, but hoppy flavorful beers. So IPAs outsell almost everything in craft beer.
Well, you know, beer is basically just malted grain, water, yeast, and some hops thrown in, right? But now other things are being added to it as well. What are you seeing out there in terms of the most creative beers you're seeing?
So fruit is really popular in beer, and especially, I'm sure we're going to get into it, as you get into things like sour beer, and you can make these additions of different foods and fruits. At my tap house, we have a beer on tap right now that actually has habanero peppers in it. And that's always really unique.
Ooh.
to get a little spice in your beer too. And, you know, when I first started drinking beer, somebody gave me a habanero beer, and I thought it was the worst thing on the planet. What a terrible idea. But brewers have gotten really good at using these non-traditional ingredients now, and now I really enjoy that type of thing.
Well, you know, when I first met you, Justin, you, for a different segment I was taping, you had me try sour beer. I'm sorry. That's just disgusting. I know there are lovers of sour beer out there.
Well, wait a second. First of all, Thuy, you were absolutely certain that I could not find a beer that you liked.
That is true.
And
that
you
true.
Left my house enjoying beer.
Yes.
Not sour beer. I'll give you that. It's weird. It's a weird style.
But you did convert
me. There's so many styles now, too. I mean, this is where I think it's fascinating where we're at right now in beer. There's, like, flavors for anybody. Like, any walk of life. If you like wine, we have beers that are aged in wine barrels. There's other beers that have just crazy hops in them, or malt, or other fruits and spices and peppers. And I mean, it's endless from the culinary perspective, because I look at a chef and a brewer very similarly as they're crafting a really neat, you know, beverage for you to drink and consume, and how you can pair with it and play with it. And what's happening in today's market is insane.
Well, Sean Paxton, explained to us what exactly is sour beer, and expand on that a little bit in terms of what kinds of beers go best with food.
Well, sour beer is a very generic, very like top level look at beer. Traditionally, there's the lambic beers from Belgium that were aged basically wildly fermented from just what was in the air, much like sourdough, and then they're put into casks, let to sit for 2 to 3 years. Sometimes fruit was added, like cherries for a creek, raspberries for a framboise, apricots, all depending on the style. And then this has kind of exploded, and now there's, you know, Berliner Weiss kind of falls under this category, which is a German-style sour beer that's very low alcohol, to all these new American sours, like what Russian River is known for, the Rare Barrel is known for. And then there's other styles of beer that they're making sour by doing the kettle souring method, where they're letting the lactobacillus that's naturally in the air and on the grain actually sour the mash, and then they'll do it brew from there. But I mean, it's crazy how many different sour beers you could see in the market today.
And when you're doing these beer food pairings, and I was lucky enough to experience one of them, and the food you make is gourmet food, you know, and it's not something that traditionally is thought of as the kind of food that goes with beer. People think more often of wine when it goes with a food pairing. So when you're doing that, are there certain beers that just don't pair well with, you know, a certain level of food when you're talking gourmet cooking?
That's a great question. And I look at it a little differently, because traditionally it's been the pub food, you know, the food from England, the food from Germany, even some of the food from Belgium. And Belgium to me has always been kind of like that sister family that I've always wanted. I look at the flavors, the dedication to that French kind of sophistication, but you have that German kind of comfort level to it. So this is kind of beyond like gastropubs and pub food. I think there really is a huge market for a lot of fine dining restaurants to actually expand their beer list to complement their wine list, because the flavors in beer, I think, actually overshadow how many flavors are in wine. Especially with all the different styles, all the different alcohol percentages, the carbonation, which actually prevents palate fatigue, especially with a multi-course dinner. I mean, there's so many different things. And really, it's about understanding the flavors that you're actually tasting in the beer, and then how you can best express those flavors.
Sean's so good at what he does, pairing beer with food, that I don't think that there are beers that you can't pair with food. In fact, I think it's better to look at it just like when we pair wine. There are certain wines that you wouldn't pair with a steak, or a certain wine you wouldn't pair with a chicken dish. And the same goes with beer. And Sean really changed my mind about that, because he was able to show me that they're complementary if you know what you're doing. I'm not saying this is an easy thing to do, but beer goes with everything. It's not the beverage. It's not your grandfather's beverage anymore.
And just like with wine, you have to – there's no general prescription. I can't say, oh, drink this with chicken.
Because it has to be Bordeaux.
Yeah. How is a chicken prepared? You know, what's that particular cook or chef's technique? And then how is that beer – you know, if it's just – if it's an example of style, there's still a margin of where that beer might lie. So it really is the individual beer to the individual dish. And that's where the magic can really come into beer and food pairing.
Spoken like a sommelier of beer. So, Nicole, you're a Cicerone, one of the few female Cicerones in the world. What do you have to do to be certified?
So I'm a Master Cicerone, which is now the fourth level of certification that's offered through the Cicerone Certification Program.
How many levels are there?
There's four.
Okay. Oh, you're at the top level.
Yes.
Okay.
And that Each level requires the passing of a increasingly difficult exam, basically. So the exam that I passed required two full days of examination with about 10 cumulative hours of essay writing, 2 hours of oral examinations with I know Sean has done the beer and food pairing exam before,
so,
but
yeah.
Not, he wasn't mine.
No, I did your paperwork.
Yeah, I think he graded mine. When I took it, 4 tasting panels, and they've increased the number of panels in short amount of time. But it's tough. It's a really stressful, long exam that covers everything from highly technical questions about draft systems. So I can take down and rebuild a pretty complex draft system, and then to beer styles, beer and food pairing. So the art and the science of beer are kind of my knowledge base.
You know, this week we had the 40th anniversary of the Judgment of Paris, right, where California wines beat out their French counterparts and kind of shocked the wine world. So a lot of people look at the Judgment of Paris as sort of at that singular point where California wines landed on the global map, and then the globalization of wine happened fairly rapidly after that. For beer, is there a singular event or a particular date that you can identify as a point where perhaps beer was able to shed more of its working class image and evolve into this more of a craft beer image, food pairing image?
You know, there's not a particular point, but there are some particular players that made it happen. I really like this topic, by the way, because I'm really proud of the U.S. for having taken these beer styles from around the world and really made them our own. And this craft beer boom that you're seeing all over the world, not just in the U.S., the U.S. has really been at the forefront of it. So you can go back to a beer company that most people, at least in the Bay Area, know about, which is Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. Yeah. And they started way early on, before anybody else was making craft beer, making homebrew out of the founder's garage. And he grew it up from there, and now they are one of the largest craft breweries in the U.S. And they took a style of beer, which was a pale ale. They made it a little bit hoppier, a little more bitter, a little more flavorful than anything else on the market. And they just blew it up. I mean, now they've got 2 breweries in 2 different parts of the U.S., and they've really pioneered this craft beer scene. Any of the smaller brewers you see coming up now will all reference Sierra Nevada Pale Ale. And that's pretty much in our backyard up here in Chico, right? So I think that's a moment. And then I think as beer became even more unique, you know, there were U.S. military or just people traveling around the world. They would come back to the U.S. and they found a rather bland beer market. American Light Lager is still the most popular beer style in the U.S. By far.
In steep decline.
It is in decline, yes. But it's still – the market share is just enormous. But what these travelers found was that they'd come back here and they really wanted to try English ale again. They wanted to have another Belgian beer. They wanted something different. So some of them began homebrewing. And then homebrewers turned into professionals. And that's really been happening over the last, you know, 15 or so years in mass, a little before that, but really in mass in the last 15 years. And now a new brewery opens in the U.S. About 2 a day. The
really?
Brewers Association estimates that a brewery opens about every 12 hours in the United States right now. And that's incredible.
It is. You know, I know that we're talking about beer pretty early in the morning. It's about 10:15, and we are not promoting alcohol, just so everybody knows out there. But you can't live in the Bay Area and be part of this, you know, fantastic food scene without talking about food and beer and wine, right? It's part of our landscape here, our culinary landscape. Just to let you know, we're discussing the growing popularity of beer and how it's gone from Budweiser and Coors. My dad loved Budweiser, by the way. To an elevated place in the Bay Area's gourmet food scene. Our guests are Justin Crossley, founder of the Brewing Network; Sean Paxton, a writer, chef, and founder of Homebrew Chef. It's a website focused on beer cuisine. And Nicole Ernie, she is one of 11 master cicerones in the world, and she knows all about beer. We're starting to get some feedback here from our listeners. Brian tweets, "When do you think the IPA craze will end? I think I know the answer."
Not soon,
which troubles me. You said the same thing Brian just said.
You know, it's not going to end soon at all, but I do find it very encouraging that right now, as craft beer enthusiasts are maturing, they are looking for other beer styles. Everybody who gets into craft beer at first goes on their own IPA craze. I did it too.
And define again what IPA is. I know you touched on it earlier at the
sure.
top.
Sure. It stands for India Pale Ale. And it essentially is a hoppier version of a pale ale. So hops, it's a flower. It's one of the four main ingredients in beer. And hops generally add bitterness to balance the sweet malt. And they also add all kinds of different other flavors and aromas that could be earthy or flowery or you name it.
Citrusy.
And I think one of the reasons for IPA's popularity is that it's a very simple ingredient to recognize and talk about. You don't have to be an expert in beer to talk about something tasting like citrus or tasting like herbally.
Tropical fruit.
Yeah. And so I think that just led to its rise in popularity. It's not going away anytime soon, but now consumers are starting to look for other options as well.
But what's interesting is our joke in the industry is that I, P, and A are the three magic letters that sell beer. And there's a lot of heat in the industry over using those letters and how they appear on the label, even.
Even if the beer isn't an IPA, yes. Sometimes it appears on a label because it sells beer.
And this is where I think it's interesting, too, because that whole concept of what is an IPA, where is it started to where it is today, the hops that are being used are different. They've been bred differently. They're being bred by flavor. And I think that's where it gets really unique because it's not just bitter, like everybody, like that bitter beer face commercial that we know from way back when. And I think it's even more interesting now because they can go tropical, they can go herbal, they can go citrusy, they can go that dank, you know, and it's so different.
Go ahead.
So a lot of breweries now are strategizing not on getting necessarily more IPAs out in their portfolio, but actually how they can create more kind of different IPAs that are going to appeal to different consumers. So we're even starting to see like fruit IPAs as this really big trend right now. And we have everything from the kind of over the top cartoonish grapefruit and pineapple flavors to some that are much more subtle and really interesting. You know, I never thought, I'm a little bit of a beer purist. I'm like, oh, I don't know about this IPA that's made with peach and pear juice. But the results can be delicious. And I think it appeals to a whole different group.
And we have another email here from Clifford, and he writes, years ago, I took a bicycle tour of England, energizing my ride with village pub stops. In the middle of the country, I came across a beer I learned to cherish, but I've never been able to find it anywhere else. So where's my Midlands Mild? Come on, local craft breweries. Anybody know where anybody can help out Clifford here?
Oh, the mild style is such a beautiful beer.
It's one of my favorites.
And
where do you get yours?
This is why I actually got into brewing myself, because there were so many styles back when I started brewing almost 20 years ago over 20 years ago, that I couldn't find. Like, I love a good German Bock. I couldn't find any in the market, so I started brewing my own, and that kind of got me into brewing. And this is where the beers that you really enjoy, if you can't find them on the market, you can very easily, listening to Justin's show. I mean, the information and the brewers that you have on the show are insane. I mean, the level of detail that you can get from just listening to the Brewing Network, I mean...
Yeah, we've interviewed some English brewers so that our homebrew listeners can learn to do it themselves. Mm-hmm. But to answer him directly about what to do right now,
what is the Midlands Mild? Define it for beer novices like me.
So the Midlands part is probably a brand.
It's the brewery.
Yeah, that's the brewery.
But a mild ale is a session strength, so meaning low alcohol, so usually in the mid 3% range, so less alcohol than a Coors Light.
Yeah. And kind of malty, a bit on the sweeter side of a beer.
It's an English style.
So Magnolia Brewery right here in San Francisco makes one of the best milds in the United States. And a mild is really meant to be fresh, too. This isn't a beer you want sitting on the shelf for too long. So when we take it, you can buy milds from England on the shelf here at a BevMo or things like that, but they just tend to age poorly.
So do you think Clifford would like the Magnolia?
I think he'd love it.
Yes.
Yeah?
It's really a great mild.
Well, Clifford,
they're bitters, they're milds. They have some wonderful beers. And they actually have a whole cask system. So this is even where, to me, it gets fun to see how beer is dispensed. Magnolia, Dave McLean, he has just this wonderful system that hardly anybody really has spent that much time and energy to focus in on how that beer should be served.
It's very traditionally English.
which it's just beautiful when you taste it fresh at the pub. And there is something to be said not going to your local beer store, but going actually to the brewery and actually trying it right there in its setting, because that's probably why that made such an impression.
Yeah.
There are a few other breweries that are focused on English styles too down in the peninsula. There's Freewheel, and they make some really nice English sessionable ales. Also on cask, so.
Okay. Well, Clifford, I hope we answered your question. If you're still listening, I would like to try some. If you buy some, you can send some my way. 2601, you know, Mariposa Street. Sean Paxton, why did you decide to specialize in beer food pairings?
Wow. I first started home brewing, and the reason why I got into brewing was, as a chef, I can make anything in 30 minutes. You know, I can make a salad, I can saute a chicken breast, whatever it was. You know, and then cheese always intrigued me. But then looking at beer, we're going to, you know, take anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 years to make a beer really intrigued me, because how those raw ingredients of barley, malt, yeast, and hops can change and transform into these just incredible flavors. And so I started home brewing. And then when you make 5 gallons of beer, you know, after about 2.5, 3 gallons, you kind of want to have something different. And I was making a dish, and the bock that I had ended up going into a venison stew that I made. And I was blown away because the flavors and the complexity that that beer added to the dish is so different than traditional, like, French cuisine that we're kind of taught. And wine usually is that alcohol. And the more I started to think about it and dive into using beer as an ingredient, you know, and using those flavors and highlighting those unique flavor characteristics, whether it's by style, whether it's the brewery's interpretation of the style, really became kind of more interesting to me than just wine. And then even more so looking at how alcohol in a dish, like let's say like a tomato vodka sauce, that vodka you don't taste, but it's helping transmit the flavors across your palate better, just like vanilla extract. You know, it's pulling that flavor out and pulling it across your palate. And that's where, to me, depending on the style of beer and how you're thinking about using it and trying to highlight those characteristics in that style, that to me is something I'm still learning every day, and I'm enjoying sharing it.
So. I'm so hungry now.
I know, me too.
And just real quickly, in like 30 seconds, can someone answer this? Rick writes, I'm not a fan of ale, so are there craft lagers that you can recommend?
Absolutely. Firestone Pivo Pils is one of my favorite lagers.
Yeah. Just classic,
and you can get
Pilsner.
That all over the Bay Area.
So good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we will continue our conversation about the increasing complexities of beer and with it the enhanced enjoyment after a short break. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Thuy Vu, in today for Michael Krasny, and you're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Thuy Vu, in today for Michael Krasny. We're talking about beer this hour, how it's growing up from its humble roots and maturing into a complex drink that's attracting even the gourmet crowd. With me in the studio are Justin Crossley, founder of The Brewing Network, a podcast focused on craft beers and home brewing. He's also the founder of Hop Grenade Tap House in Concord. Also in the studio is Sean Paxton, writer, chef, and founder of Homebrew Chef. It's a website focused on beer cuisine. And also Nicole Ernie. She's one of 11 Master Cicerones in the world and was the first female Master Cicerone, former bartender at the Trappist in Oakland as well, and now has her own consulting firm, and she does work with the Cicerone Certification Program. Great to have all of you here. Have you all always been beer lovers, or are you wine lovers as well, or do the two not go hand in hand?
So whenever people ask me about what got me into beer, I always go to this one point, which is that beer presents the whitest possibility of flavor experience of any alcoholic beverage.
Meaning what?
So the different flavors that you can experience in just drinking beer as an overall category is so immense. You can have everything from something that's very light and thin and highly carbonated to something that has a really full, intense flavor, and then everything in between. Brewers also have more ingredients to work with than winemakers, for example, because they have the four basic ingredients of beer. So your malt, your water, your yeast, your hops. They can also add other things. They can add other grains. They can add spices, flowers, etc., and really achieve almost any flavor that the brewer wants. And because of that, and because of the comparatively low price point that beer still maintains, even as we get into really specialty beers, you know, really exquisite, expensive, quote unquote, bottle of beer might set you back $60 or $70 for something extremely rare. But overall, the price point's still low. So that kind of 1-2 punch of what you can experience in beer, and it's relatively low cost, just makes it so appealing to me. And people in my demographic agree. Women in their mid-20s to mid-30s are the fastest growing group of craft beer drinkers.
So we have our phones are lighting up. Philip in Burlingame wants to weigh in on our beer conversation. Good morning, Philip. Welcome to the forum.
Good morning. Great conversation. You know, it seems like American craft brews are going towards IPAs and very strong flavored hopsy beers. But in my time spent in England, I loved, bitters, which are not bitter. They're actually kind of a thin, more watery type beer, which is very drinkable. You could drink 6 pints a night. I know Magnolia makes it, but it doesn't seem to be distributed. And I'm wondering, you know, what's up with bitters?
It's a great question, because ESB, I love the sessionability of that style, as well as it's a great food beer because it's fully packed with flavor, but, you know, it won't leave you after 5 or 6. You're still totally standing. I mean, it's only like 3-4% alcohol.
Yeah.
I mean,
there's a couple of problems, I think, in the American market with beers like that, with bitters and milds. And one of those is that craft beer tends to be a little more expensive than macro beer, is what we call the American light lager. And for that, you find that many consumers want a little more bang for their buck. So if they look on a menu and actually see the very thing that the caller likes about the beer, which is a lower alcohol, some consumers don't want to spend money for less alcohol. So I think that that's one small problem that we run into. I think the other one is that it's a beer that's best tasted fresh. It doesn't travel well, and it doesn't distribute
hold up.
So if you have a local brewery that's willing to make it because they'll sell enough of it, then you're in great shape. But if you have a brewery that wants to send it across the country and have it widely distributed, the style just tends to go south, which doesn't do it any favors when a consumer buys it off the shelf.
But I think also the naming of it, you know, just like a brown ale, I think is also a style that is so good with food, because the melanoidin-rich malts that are very similar to caramelized onions, shallots, mm-hmm. leeks, garlic, those flavors are wonderful. But yet, again, being brown, it's never caught on. And like bitter, like, oh, I don't want a bitter beer, but it's not really bitter. And that's
right.
The thing. It's like this misnomer as far as, oh, I want that mild, but, you know, I want something full flavored. Well, it actually is.
It can be.
A related current trend in beer, though, is our session beers.
Yes.
So you see that a lot. Actually, there was just a beer festival in Jack London Square last weekend called the Session Beer Fest.
Yeah.
It's put on by Drake's Brewing Company, and they think they partnered with Trumer. You see all of these delicious and flavorful beers that are brewed to lower alcohol, as well as some beers that are just naturally lower in alcohol. For example, Gosa, which is really popular, mm-hmm. slightly sour and slightly salty beer style in the Bay Area. Yeah.
And by the way, session is an interesting term in itself, Twee. We call them session beers because you can drink a lot of them in one session and not be inebriated because they're lower in alcohol and things. So I just think it's a funny thing. We throw it out like it's a common term. It's a session beer. I always like where the term came from.
It's
so you can drink
beer.
A lot.
But it's been interesting, too, to see the trend and the change from these super hoppy double IPAs into these session IPAs mm-hmm. to help it balance out, because I think, you know, again, showing the balance in beer and the restraint of the brewer and try to pulling out flavors and to find that harmonious flavors of the hop and then the malt to support it, but then to to have the alcohol be right and ultimately, you know, your experience of that beer to be enjoyable.
Yeah. Okay, we're getting a bunch of emails as well. I just want to read a couple of fun ones. Russ writes, I became a craft beer enthusiast a few years ago. I gained weight. My stomach ballooned just from drinking a beer or two a day. I gave it up. I miss it, but I'm trim again and my sex life is a lot better. Okay, Russ. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. And Galen also writes, check out the comic book Story of Beer. It's a great graphic novel explaining the history of beer. And also, more callers lined up. Let's go to our next caller, Mary in Pacifica. Welcome to Forum.
Hello. So I have a question. I make tinctures and extracts, and I have planted a bunch of hops in my backyard, which are doing fabulous. But my kids moved all the markers for what types of hops it was. And I read that the only way to figure it out is through genetic testing, which hops plant is which. Is this true? And does it matter?
You're in trouble, and it doesn't matter. Just use them anyway. It is very, very difficult to figure out what you have if they're unlabeled.
It's not quite like wine grapes where you can look at the leaf, but the leaf will kind of help you a little bit.
The leaf and the cone shape can, if you know what you had started with.
And the smell and the aroma. I mean, if you know at least what you planted, you can kind of help a little bit with that. But then depending on your soil, and especially in Pacifica, because I used to live there, yeah. I understand, you know, just how that changes things a little bit without the sun.
If you're serving beer, we'll come over and try to identify them for you.
Mary, I hope you feel like you're, you want to throw a party? It's Memorial Day weekend. We'll all come over.
They're not ready yet.
It's okay. We're a casual bunch.
That's right.
Think about that and get back to me, okay? All right. Thanks for joining and thanks for calling in. Have a good weekend. Let's go to our next caller, Brian in Oakland. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning.
Do you have a comment or question?
Yeah. I was curious as to if you have any recommendations or can elaborate on aging beers in bottles. I know that stouts age really well, but is there a reason that porters do or do not age well, and also IPAs, and how long a good duration is?
Well, that's a big question because it all kind of depends on some different factors. One, most IPAs, the reason why you're drinking an IPA is that you want those hops to be fresh and floral and really present. The longer a beer sits, those hops, the oils actually are falling out of suspension, so you won't taste them as much. And so the longer the beer ages, the less dramatic that hop punch will be. Depending on the beer style, the alcohol content is also an important factor. And if the bottle is actually bottle conditioned with yeast, that actually is going to help with oxidation issues. Usually like your barley wines, your imperial stouts are going to be great age because the hop balance and the maltiness will kind of become more malty over time. But then again, it depends on the style of beer because some of the Belgian beers like the sour lambics, I've had some that were 20, 30 years old that were incredible because just the time to break down the different starches and sugars as well as overall the chemistry that's happening in that bottle. But, you know, a lot of beer styles you want to have fresh.
A lot of beers, as you age them, just kind of move into the same direction where they just start to taste like fruitcake, you know? And usually, I mean, I'm actually not a proponent of aging beer in general. There are certain things that I do keep in my cellar, which, by the way, I keep at normal refrigerator temperatures, and I do keep bottles upright to keep the sediment on the bottom. Otherwise, you can get some off flavors from yeast. If you want to keep them for a shorter time, you can put them at wine cellar temperatures. But it's not so much style you're looking for. It's that ABV. You want really higher alcohol beer. And you also want a beer that maybe wasn't as good as it could have been the first time you opened it. So there are some strong beers like the Firestone Walker Anniversary Series, or like that some of the sour beers from Russian River that have fruits. And I don't age those because I consider those ready to go when they leave the brewery. They taste as good as they're going to taste. But if you open a bottle and you're like, ooh, the bitterness is a little harsh or the alcohol is way out of proportion, sometimes age can help.
Well, it's that taste test. Thank you for that question. Let's go now to Ken in San Francisco. Good morning, Ken.
Morning. I find myself preferring Guinness or Boddington's with a meal because of the lower level of carbonation. I don't think I'm alone in that preference. I'm wondering why I don't encounter more such beers.
Well, actually, both of those beers are interesting beers because they're not using CO2 as much as they're using nitrogen. It's a, actually, it's a 60-40 blend of CO2 and nitrogen. So you still have that creaminess and the bubbles, but it is a less aggressive beer. And if you think about CO2, carbon dioxide is actually an acid, carbonic acid. So the more carbonation a beer has, it is a little harsher because of that.
There are breweries that are doing those beers being served on nitrogen. The problem is that it's kind of expensive and difficult to package in a can or bottle. And that's why you see Guinness doing it. Yeah. They're a very large brewery. They have the resources to do so. Smaller brewers can't do it as much, although you are seeing some come to the market now. Mm-hmm. But you will find them on tap at your local brewery. Lots of breweries do like to do nitro beers.
Yeah. I have a love and hate relationship with carbonation because I love it, but my stomach does not always, especially if I'm eating. So one thing that I'll do is I'll just aggressively pour the beer.
Between two glasses?
No, not that extreme. As long, if you do like a 7-minute pour in a beer and you pour it upright, let the head really form, that takes away a good amount of the carbonation. So that's a nice thing is when you can't add carbonation to your can of Guinness, but you can take it away from your bottle of whatever else.
All right, let me take a moment to give out our number once again. If you would like to join the discussion about beer, the growing complexities, the evolution, the enhanced enjoyment, go ahead and give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And Nicole, what's it like being a woman in the beer industry? I mean, we have heard, accounts of sexism in the beer industry.
There's always some hot topics about it right now. Overall, the beer industry in general is pretty welcoming of women. There are a lot of prominent women in the industry. We have a wonderful all women organization called the Pink Boot Society, of which San Francisco has a very active chapter. So if you are a woman that makes any part of your income from beer, you're welcome to join. It's very active. We just did a field trip to Sierra Nevada, a bunch of other things. There's definitely been a push to connect women because the kind of sexism that we experience is kind of like not malicious, but kind of the black unicorn, you know? you're a woman. You're such a rare species in this industry. And more than flavor, that's the most common question I get, which is sometimes, a disappointment. Because I want to talk about beer.
Of course. It's a predominantly male industry. That's changing quite a bit, although like everything, it changes rather slowly. I think it's funny what Nicole points out. When I started my company 10 years ago and I would go to beer festivals, it was rare to find women there. And now it's a little more. And I've even put my foot in my mouth before trying to welcome women into it because I was so excited that it wasn't just men anymore. And I would single out a woman at a fest in a way, thanking her for being there, doing the exact thing she didn't want done, which was to stand out like a sore thumb. But for me, I was really just trying to say, I'm so glad this is changing finally.
All right, let's go back to the phones and say hello to David in Berkeley. David, thank you for being so patient with us.
Hey, good morning, folks. Very edifying conversation. I think I'll take it to a slightly different direction. I am a rabbinic kosher supervisor from a local Northern California agency. What we do is we give kosher certification to foods and beverages and events for the kosher consuming public. Now, one of the big concerns I've had, I'm a beer lover, okay, goes without saying. Now, one of the great things about beer in general is that there's no need for it to have kosher supervision, unlike wine, which is a very picky thing in traditional Judaism. And my fear is that as we get, I'm sure already grape extracts have been added to beer, but it's unusual. My question is, so I think you see where I'm going with this. My concern is that as beers get more and more detailed and sort of gourmet, are we going to have to start worrying about the previously no-worry ingredients, that went into it, And then the terrible thing that would happen is all beers would have to go through this kosher supervision process to be acceptable, you know,
okay,
and that would get expensive.
So. There are a few concerns like that that I bring up to my brewer friends frequently because ingredients are starting to become more common in beer like lactose. I tasted a milk stout, it wasn't a milk stout. It was a different beer style. It was actually a pale ale. And they use lactose. So there's a tradition of using lactose, which is milk sugar, in beer to kind of thicken the body. It makes it very, very creamy. And it doesn't make it sweet. It just adds a really nice mouthfeel to the beer. And I tasted it. I was like, wow, this mouthfeel is amazing. And they go, oh, there's lactose in it. And I look at the bottle and I'm like, that's not listed on the bottle, and you could make someone pretty sick.
Sure.
And now we are also seeing nuts in beer. And so I worry it's definitely the doormat for regulation. There are some concerns.
Vegan, you know, because of some of the chemicals that are used to fine a beer actually come from like fish bladders or
gelatin.
Gelatin. I mean, there's all these different ways to use that too. So that's also been an issue.
The caller makes a good point that if it gets to a regulation point for these things, it's difficult for everybody. Right now, beer is a very safe beverage. It doesn't require a whole lot of health department oversight. But he's right. If Nicole's right too. If we have to start listing all these ingredients, which we probably should, it could get difficult. There is a brewery, Schmaltz Brewing Company, by the way, that was partially based out of San Francisco here. Yeah, always kosher, that beer. Yep.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Let's go to Chris in Menlo Park because Chris has been waiting very patiently as well. Good morning, Chris.
Hi.
Hi. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. I found out that I like beers in a certain IBU range. And usually when I go to a bar, I can't find out what the IBU range. And a lot of times the guy taking the menu, the order doesn't even know what I'm talking about.
Ooh, that's bad news for me. So my tap house in Concord, the Hop Grenade, excuse the shameless plug, we take this kind of thing very seriously. For one, our staff needs to know about every beer that we have on the menu. The fun part of that for them is if they come into work one day and there's a new beer on they haven't tried, they have to try it. It's part of their job. We also make certain that we list not only the IBUs, but the alcohol content, the name of the brewery, where the brewery's from. We want you to have all of that information. And I do think that that's changing widely in the industry as retailers embrace craft beer and the consumers like you who really want to know about it, they're starting to list these things too.
What is IPU again?
IBU, International Bittering Units. And it's a way to tell how many, how much of a hoppy beer it is, if it's more toward the malty side, which would be sweeter, or more toward the bitter, flavorful side that hops add.
Okay, I want to return to the phone lines. Let's see here. Who do we have now? John in Pacifica, good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. Thank you. Love the discussion. I work retail, and I field a lot of beer questions at my store. Several years ago, I had a customer pick up one of our private label bottles. She shook up the bottle. She looked at the bubbles inside the bottle and told me that the beer was too young to drink. And I've been flabbergasted for years wondering if there's any reality to this or if this person was just making something up.
She was crazy.
Yeah, that's not a thing.
Maybe in moonshine, but not in beer.
I hope you sleep well tonight knowing that there was no relevance to that assessment.
There you go,
check that
John.
Off your list. It's over.
We've got a unanimous opinion on that from our panel of experts. Let's say good morning now to Dan in Campbell. Good morning.
Good morning. Hefeweizen. I lived in Germany, southwest Germany. The beer I loved there actually was an internal export from province to province called Maiswolf. Can't find anything really like it here. Where am I looking? I'm not looking in the right place.
Well, and it's interesting that you bring that up because this is where I struggle a lot. There's so many wonderful beer styles, but the market doesn't always hold them, and there's a lot of seasonality in beer. You know, we're coming into the summer months. We like the lower alcohol beers like the Hefeweizen, which, you know, has that banana clove flavor. It's a heavy wheat malt beer that is so refreshing, the carbonation in it.
Can't be beat.
And
the local stuff's a little too hoppy, I guess. I don't know.
And that's what's interesting, too, is because drinking seasonal it's a weird thing, and a lot of people aren't doing it. But, you know, when you look at Pilsners and versus like Imperial Stouts and barley wines in the winter, box and the fall beers, you know, the pumpkin beers, it's very interesting to see what the market bears. But I will say to you, you know, this is where you as a consumer who has money and cash, you know, you start asking more and more for certain beers, or email the brewer or email the establishment, you know, say, hey, I would really like to have some other beer styles besides the 10 IPAs you have on tap.
Yeah. If you lived in the East Bay, I'd have a lot of recommendations of where to shop for you, but I'm not so sure about your neck of the woods. I'm sure Harry's Hofbräu has some Hefeweizens on.
Okay. Yeah. Good suggestion. So. You are listening to Forum. We're talking about beer this hour, the evolution of beer, and our guests are Justin Crossley, co-founder of the Brewing Network, Sean Paxton, writer, chef, and founder of Homebrew Chef, and Nicole Ernie, a master cicerone of beer. She's based in Oakland. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Thuy Vu. And just to continue the thought, we have an email here from Johanna, and Johanna writes, what about really good non-alcoholic beers that have flavor and are not sweet? There are some good ones available in Europe right now. Are American craft brewers making good ones also?
You know, I'm going to just go ahead and say no. This is a personal preference, I think, as well. But, you know, there's just really something missing from a beer. Beer was invented with alcohol, and to take a main ingredient out, I think really changes the beverage in a way that, to me, it actually no longer tastes like beer. So I have a hard time with non-alcoholic beverages, even though I understand the request for them. I've never tasted one that tasted enough like beer for me to enjoy.
I would agree with you.
Yeah, even the European ones. A reason why craft brewers are kind of unable to make them is because the process of removing the alcohol damages a lot of the other flavors in the beer. You get kind of a cardboardy taste, which is really prevalent in most non-alcoholic beer.
And Marcio writes, are there brewing classes and courses around the Bay Area?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm teaching some classes in the Bay Area. I don't have one on my schedule right now, but if you visit my website, NicoleErnie.com, sorry for the plug, you can sign up on my mailing list and hear about them. I also teach for the Cicerone program. So we do some beer flavor standards classes and things like that. If you're interested in the business of beer, Food Craft Institute at East Bay School offers a business of beer class every year in the fall. And then these guys probably know about some more as well.
Just online resources. You can hear Nicole on thebrewingnetwork.com. She's done a lot of shows for me. Sean Paxton does a show for me about food and beer. And we're really education-based in our podcasts.
Okay, great.
And with my website, too, I do a lot of stuff with homebrewchef.com where I teach you how to not only drink beer, taste beer, but also cook with beer and pair with beer.
And actually, that leads me into the next call about drinking beer. Gary in Napa, you have a question about drinking beer and the safety aspects.
Yes, I am an ER doc, and recently I had a patient who drank a brewed beer from a friend of his who's in the wine industry, and the very next day he started getting diarrhea. And that persisted for a few days. I mean, he's a young, healthy adult, but he ended up coming to the ER with a fever. And his cultures grew out Campylobacter, which is a bacteria that can cause serious gastroenteritis. And so I was wondering about food poisoning from beer and illness from people who drink these, especially craft beers that are maybe as sanitary as they can be.
That's definitely a misconception. Craft beer is absolutely going to be just as sanitary as any other beer. It tends not to be pasteurized. However, they make up for that with much more cleanliness on the production side. So you actually have less microbial activity.
And alcohol.
And so the other consideration is it's not technically possible at this point. I always believe in the power of microbes, but as of now, there are no known pathogens that can survive in 1.5% of alcohol and up. So unless that person is very sensitive to certain gluten. Yeasts, which is possible.
Or gluten.
Gluten or yeah, something else that's another ingredient in the beer. Because there's somebody that's allergic to pretty much anything you can think of. Yeah. It does not pose an immediate health or safety risk. No.
Okay. Gary, I hope that answers your question. We have a bunch of emails in as well. Mike writes, IPA is the most popular beer style. What do you see as the second and third most popular beers today and in the future?
Wow. Nicole, why don't you answer that? Because I always get this wrong. I'm in such a beer nerd world that I think what I end up thinking is popular is not popular at all.
Yeah, and well, I mean, changing. We're on the same boat. It's hard to move, you know, past your personal preference. But honestly, I think that the next popular beer style after IPA it's going to be IPA.
Surprise. Just, shock.
So, I mean, here's the thing. We are the beer producing country in the world right now. Everyone around the world is looking to the U.S. for our production techniques, our beer styles, and our ingredients. American hops 100 years ago were the laughing stock of the world. And now they are the most desired in the world. Even new American brewers are having a hard time getting our homegrown hops into their beers. And just thinking about how historical trends in beers have happened before, this is not going away. Yeah. So I think that there's going to continue to be a lot of innovation. If you look at IPA now versus 10 years ago, it's a totally different animal. We've really been influenced by West Coast brewing, drier, more flavor.
That was a great discussion. I want to thank you all. I am now officially hungry.
I'm thirsty.
Thanks, and me too. Thanks to our guest, Justin Crossley, co-founder of the Brewing Network, Sean Paxton of Homebrew Chef, a website focused on beer cuisine, and Nicole Ernie, an Oakland-based master cicerone. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Mel Baker. Our engineer today is Howard Gilman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online help from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadad. I'm Tui Vu, in today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.